Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned downtown Columbus restaurant, taproom, and brewery, showcasing seasonal menus and more than 20 Wolf's Ridge beers on draft. Learn more at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The novel coronavirus known as COVID-19 has officially landed in Ohio. Three cases have been confirmed in Cuyahoga County. Governor Mike DeWine on Monday declared a state of emergency and warned Ohioans to gird for changes.
From what we see around the world and in the United States, this disease will for a period, significantly disrupt our lives.
Speaking of disruption, when Ohio State students return from spring break next week, they'll go online for classes at least until March 30th. We're going to talk with OSU President Michael Drake about that next hour. Andy Chow is a reporter with the Ohio State House News Bureau. He is covering the state response to COVID-19. Welcome back, Andy.
Good morning, Ann.
What is known about the three Ohioans who have tested positive?
Yeah, so there, a couple of different pieces of information have come out since that press conference yesterday. There are three Ohioans. All three of them are in their mid-50s in Cuyahoga County. One is a married couple in their mid-50s, a man and a woman, who recently just came back to Ohio from a Nile River cruise. One started to feel sick, and then the other started to feel sick, and then one had to be hospitalized. And I believe is, and they're both in isolation now. And then the third case is a completely separate case from that married couple. That's another man in his mid-50s who recently traveled to Washington, D.C. to go to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. That's the AIPAC committee that we've heard other cases coming from. That man also returned to Cuyahoga County, started to feel sick, was tested for COVID-19 and tested positive.
You know, I mean, this is a time of year when people get sick. What's distinguishing COVID-19? Is it where they've been and that's why they've gone to get tested?
Well, there's all sorts of things that can play a role. If they have a sustained fever, if they're having respiratory issues, it presents itself basically like the common cold, but something that it becomes severe enough of a problem that you need to go see a doctor, especially if you have a fever that just keeps continuing or a cough that keeps continuing. And then from there, doctors can sort of figure out the difference between if it's a cold or if it's something else. And there are testing protocols in place by the state now to determine if somebody should go, if that case should continue on to be tested for the coronavirus or what's known as COVID-19.
The state wasn't able to start testing for COVID-19 until this past weekend. Is there any sense about how long they think the virus has been in Ohio?
They've been saying for the past couple of weeks now, they have been warning that it's very possible that this coronavirus has already been in Ohio, that people have already had it in one way or another, and that it's been passing through, and that they just haven't been able to test for it. But for the past couple of weeks, I want to say about 3 weeks now, they have been able to take what have been presented to be maybe the most severe cases who come into a doctor's office, and then those cases are passed up to the state level. They have been able to send those tests over to the CDC, so up to the national level in order to perform tests there. And all of those tests up until yesterday had come back negative. So if it had been in Ohio, it was not that severe. It wasn't spreading as harshly as people might be fearing. And I think it's a good time to sort of take a step back. Whenever we talk about this, and we're going to be talking about this a lot of public officials have been stressing that it's important to prepare and to be ready for the different disruptions that are about to come. But it's also important to not panic. So take this seriously, but don't panic.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about COVID-19 today. Three cases were announced officially yesterday by Governor Mike DeWine. My guest right now is Andy Chow. He's a reporter for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. He's been covering the issue. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292 8513. Coming up, we're going to hear from an epidemiologist, a specialist from the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. And we're also going to hear from a local employer who 2 years ago created sick pay and time off for employees when they become ill, so that it doesn't have the economic impact that so many people are worried it will when it hits. Andy Chow, how many test kits or how do they enumerate the tests? How are they being counted? How many did Ohio get? Are there enough?
We're talking about how many tests have been performed or how many kits have they received?
How many kits they've received.
I'm not exactly sure how many kits they received. What happens is that they have a couple of different items where they're able to collect different samples, put it together, calibrate it, and then put it into a machine to test it all. They have video of all this, actually, up on their website. And so I believe they have two or three. I'm not quite sure. What I do know is that they are trying to maximize their resources, so that is why they have protocols in place to be able to make sure that the people who are most at risk or most vulnerable to COVID-19 are getting the test first, and then from there on they have a three-prong approach on who can get tests after that. And I also think it's important to add that there are two private labs, LabCorp and Quest, that also have testing mechanisms now, so they're also able to perform tests as well.
What does the governor's declaration of a state of emergency do?
So he sort of downplayed this because I think one of the things is he didn't want to, again, incite too much panic, but he says it's important to sign the state of emergency because this helps the state acquire resources at a quicker rate. So if they needed to go get new materials for this or that, they're able to get it more instantly instead of going through a bid process. So that really kind of opens up another avenue towards getting resources faster, and that just kind of gets the system going quicker. They've also opened up their emergency management center, which is just sort of the mechanism that the state has in place to help all the different agencies more quickly respond to certain situations. It sort of opens up communication among all the agencies so that they can respond to things quicker.
The Ohio General Assembly is on a break right now, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Has anyone talked about whether they're going to come back?
You know, so right now we might be seeing a committee hearing here or there, but right now, and this is typical for every election season, they're in their districts, the legislators are in their districts, gearing up for the primary, running for re-election. And so I think that conversation is sort of delayed until after the primary results, after next week's primary. So there hasn't been much talk of it yet. There have been leaders who have been, you know, making PSAs and trying to get the word out there, trying to support the DeWine administration when it comes to getting the word out there of different ways you can prevent the spread of germs, prevent the spread of the virus, such as washing your hands, minimizing contact with other people, avoiding large crowds.
Dr. Amy Acton, Ohio Department of Health Director, talked yesterday about the focus on high-risk individuals. Who are those people? Because they're saying older people. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's and they're the first to admit that it's a very general statement at this point. They've been saying, quote, the elderly. But what Dr. Amy Acton and other public health officials have been saying as far as the age goes is that there's not enough data worldwide to really support where exactly that age cutoff is, because what Acton was saying is even people in their 40s and 50s have been shown to be more vulnerable to the virus than people younger than 40. At this point, they've been trying to just sort of generalize, so people who are in their 60s and 70s are the most vulnerable or the most high risk. But they are saying that people who are in their 40s and 50s should also be taking this virus seriously. If you start to feel sick, you should go see a doctor and see what you can do from there and do whatever you can to prevent the spread of germs and prevent your own contact with germs.
New York Governor Cuomo the other day spoke to people potentially prepared to gouge consumers on things like, you know, hand sanitizers and that kind of a thing. Did the Governor DeWine bring up any of those issues yesterday?
He didn't talk about that from maybe any sort of commercial standpoint. He just was urging people to be prepared, to make sure you have what you need. And a lot of what the governor said yesterday was sort of alluding to the situations that have happened in other states. And I think a lot of people are watching the state of Washington and what's happening in that state and then cities like Seattle to find out what exactly is going on. And so when they talk about major disruptions and when they talk about preparing and like you said, maybe stockpiling up on things, we have seen sort of a back order on things like hand sanitizer, disinfectant wipes, disinfectant spray. DeWine didn't talk about the commercial side of that or the possibility of what you said, like sort of like price gouging.
Mm-hmm.
But what he was trying to say is that people should be prepared and sort of keep your eye on what's happening in Washington. You already mentioned, Anne, that OSU canceled all on-campus classes, so students are going to be taking classes online instead for the rest of the month.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that happened in Seattle. That's something that happened at the University of Washington. They've also canceled a lot of large events. So what DeWine is alluding to is it's possible that what's happening in Seattle and the state of Washington could very well be happening in Columbus and in Ohio.
Have you heard about any other universities in Ohio following suit?
So I've been looking around. A lot of the public state universities have been putting out updates, and they have special sections of their website to keep students informed. At this point, I couldn't find any other university that has made any major changes to their on-campus activities. But from what these updates have been saying is that just keep an eye on their website because that can change daily. What we do know, what was announced last night, is that Shawnee State University announced that they have 3 suspected coronavirus cases under investigation. Everybody at Shawnee State University who might have had possible contact with those 3 potential cases are now being quarantined, and the tests are pending on those 3 people. But Shawnee State says there's no interruption in campus activities at this point. But again, just like many other universities, they're asking students, staff, faculty to keep an eye on their webpage, keep an eye out for updates, because this is something that can change on a daily basis.
Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose is holding a press conference this morning to talk about the state's plans to stop the spread of COVID-19 during the primary election next week. What are you expecting that they'll be doing about that?
Well, he's actually talking as we speak in the room above me, so we're going to get more details. But what we did sort of get a preview of from what DeWine said and what Frank LaRose had put out last night is just different changes in different parts of the primary system. And one of the biggest things is that there are more than 75 polling locations located in nursing homes around the state.
Yeah.
DeWine said that those will be moved. We're waiting for official confirmation on that from Frank LaRose, but I think it's fair to say that's going to happen. So 75 polling locations that are usually in nursing homes are expected to move. And so that's something that voters need to be looking out for. If you have a polling location in a nursing home, be sure to check with the state to make sure you know where you're voting. They also want to make sure that the proper protocols are in place for voting locations that are at schools. Usually, and I'm sure most people who vote at a school see that, you know, you go through the back door and you never interact with students or you never interact with any surfaces like tables that students use.
Mm-hmm.
But the state's just making it very clear to separate voting activity from school activity to make sure that they can contain any type of spread of germs there.
Okay, well, then I guess we just stand by for more news as things unfold, and we will have Andy Chow with us, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter. We are focused on COVID-19 today. Coming up, we're going to hear from Dr. Christina Leshensky. She's an infectious disease expert at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. So stay with us. If you have any questions, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned downtown Columbus restaurant, taproom, and brewery, showcasing seasonal menus and more. Stop by to enjoy one of more than 20 Wolf's Ridge beers on tap.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The novel coronavirus known as COVID-19 has officially landed in Ohio. Three cases have been confirmed in Cuyahoga County. Governor Mike DeWine on Monday declared a state of emergency and warned Ohioans to gird for change. For example, when Ohio State students return from spring break next week, they'll go online for classes at least until March 30th. One of the greatest challenges of this virus is that it spreads quickly. Still with us is Ohio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. And Dr. Christina Lishinesky is an infectious disease expert at OSU Wexner Medical Center. She joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
From the beginning, it's been compared to the flu, with a lot of people saying that the flu is a bigger problem and kills thousands every year. What kind of context do you describe it? Do you compare it to the flu?
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely correct. The way that the virus spread is consistent with the way that the flu is spread. It is via droplets, mostly between close contacts. The flu does, it killed like 18,000 people this year so far, according to the CDC. So obviously it's touched many more people. People are more at risk from dying of the flu, particularly younger people and pregnant women. This particular virus, it's appearing like the older population is more at risk. So when we say older, we're saying over 60 years old. At this point, it doesn't appear that pregnant women are more at risk. So those are some of the differences between the two viruses.
The New York Times reported that the virus may have been spreading in Washington state for weeks without being noticed. We've heard reports that Ohio public health officials think that that might be the case in Ohio as well.
So unfortunately, the virus looks like any other respiratory virus, and there are literally thousands of respiratory viruses. So it's really hard to delineate which specific virus is causing your symptoms unless you do a test. And as you know, Ohio did get testing on Saturday, and also some send-out labs are offering testing as well. So we're able to send some specimens to our local send-out lab.
But how do you track it if not everybody's, if everybody with a cough isn't getting tested?
Well, you can't track it unless you have a positive test.
And
yeah.
So the way we track the flu is actually is we actually report patients who are flu positive who are hospitalized. So that gets reported to the local health department, and that's where the numbers come from.
Okay. Andy Chow?
Yeah, and Dr. Lishinesky's right. And you bring up a good point because it looks like any sort of other respiratory illness that it's hard to track. And so when it comes to the state protocols and how they're allowing doctors to order for tests, the very first thing is if you are somebody, again, who is in that high-risk group, and then they try to see, did you have contact with somebody who has been confirmed to have COVID-19? Were you ever in any of the geographical areas that have a high number of coronavirus, like China, South Korea, Italy? And then if you have a fever that's been sustained for a long time and doctors just cannot figure it out. So I think the history and the evidence of having contact with somebody who already has the virus, or if you yourself have been in an area with a high number of viruses, that's sort of some of the indicators that they're using at this point.
Dr. Lishinesky, if it's not as dangerous as the flu, why are we so worried about it?
So that's a great question. So anything new is novel and people are concerned because it is a new thing. I wish everyone was as concerned about the flu as they are about the coronavirus. Here at the hospital, we are always very concerned about influenza. We recommend vaccinations. We have an influenza work group that meets monthly, during the year to prepare for flu season. So I would be thrilled if people were as worried about the flu as they were about the coronavirus.
Are you concerned, Dr. Lishinesky, as far as OSU shutting down, what kind of impact that could have on, you know, medical facilities? It doesn't affect you?
So a university closure does not affect the medical center at this time, no.
Even with students being kept at home?
No, we are prepared to take care of our patients. So we've actually set up a call center to help our providers triage patients as well. So, you know, we are up and moving at full steam.
What do you make of the fact that this seems to be harder on people over the age of 60? 60 is not that old, I like to think.
Sure. So in general, respiratory viruses, so particularly like respiratory syncytial virus or RSV or metapneumovirus, which is a little bit more of a destructive respiratory viruses, they do cause significant illness in our immunocompromised patients, particularly our bone marrow transplant patients and our cancer patients. And people do, unfortunately, sometimes die from those viruses. So this is not completely unprecedented that this respiratory virus will cause some people who are immunocompromised or elderly with poor medical reserve to pass away.
And then the issue of masks, that's just been ongoing. You can't find them anywhere, but there's disputes about whether they work anyways, unless you're actually sick. Right, doctor?
Yeah, so there, if you're not symptomatic, then wearing a mask is unlikely to protect you. The mask itself is most helpful to prevent you from spreading symptoms to someone else. So if you're not sick, then you don't need to wear a mask because you don't have any symptoms to spread.
Let's see, Tom and Gahanna, you're on. Oh, I'm sorry, Andy.
I wanted to sort of say something, and I don't know if Dr. Lishinesky might have something to add to this, but the question about comparing this to the flu, I think World Health Organization officials have said that the seasonal flu, the mortality rate is about 0.1%, and although the figures are early and we're still getting new numbers, the mortality rate for coronavirus is between 1 to 3, 3.4%.
Sure, that's correct. We just don't have, we're not testing everybody who is ill with coronavirus. So
and
we don't have the denominator data.
And does it matter that we don't, I mean, a lot of people do get the flu shot, even though I'm sure in your opinion, not enough, Dr. Lishinesky, but no one's had a vaccination for the novel coronavirus.
Yeah, correct. And that's an important point to point out that vaccines are effective and important, and they do help. There is no vaccine for coronavirus in general. So,
And when we talk about a compromised immune system, could you be compromised by the flu if you get the flu and they get the coronavirus on top of it?
So typically people who get the flu, there is... do worry about a little bit about post-influenza pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
That's typically caused by a bacteria, which is different than a virus.
Okay.
Regarding co-infection with coronavirus and flu, you very plausibly can happen. We just haven't tested enough people to know if that's happening or not.
Okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Ex-Dr. Christina Lishinesky, she's an infectious disease expert at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. Also with us, Andy Chow, the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. He's been covering this issue at the state level. Tom and Gahanna, you're on the air. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hey, thank you so much for this program and for giving all this good, competent information. I also want to embarrass Andy. Many years ago, he was a youth Boy Scout training leader out here with the Boy Scouts, and I'm glad to see where his career has gone. My question is, being a good Catholic, I do go to communion. Can this, the flu or this new virus be transmitted through the mouth when receiving Holy Communion? Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thank you, Tom, for that call. Dr. Lishinesky?
Sure, absolutely. And actually, the church that I attend, they stopped doing the wine a month or so ago due to the flu.
So you shouldn't be participating in that at this point.
You shouldn't be sharing drinks with other people.
Okay, but the wafer is.
The wafer is safe.
Should be safe. Okay, mm-hmm. Great. What do you recommend, Dr. Lishinesky, for everyday people to protect themselves from this? People are worried, obviously. Is buying out the hand sanitizer the answer?
No, I think the same thing that the CDC has been saying is, practice good hygiene. Wash your hands, soap and water. Hand sanitizer is fine as well. Cover your cough. Stay away from people who are sick if you can. Those kind of common sense things.
Are you at all concerned about people voting next week?
I am not concerned, and I've honestly not thought about it.
Okay. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you have a question, Andy Chow, is there any sense, did the governor say that he's talked about, disruption? So far, Ohio State has shut down in-person classes, but are we expecting to see the streets empty out?
At this point, we're just not sure. Again, he just keeps sort of referring to other places. If you look at Italy right now, that has, it's a hot zone, mm-hmm. and they're implementing very strong regulations, like you said, trying to even stop people from going from one municipality to another. He stopped short of saying just how stringent things will become, because we just don't know. And like Dr. Lishinesky pointed out, we just don't even know how many cases are currently in Ohio. And if we see ramped up testing, then we might know more. But I think what's going to happen, and what the DeWine administration has been pushing really strongly, is that we are going to see daily updates. So from a day-to-day basis, we might learn more information about what exactly is going to happen. For example, we talked about the NCAA March Madness tournament. Mm-hmm. There are going to be games scheduled in Dayton and Cleveland. And he stopped short of saying if there's been an announcement or if there's been a decision on that, but he said that his health advisory council has been talking with people and they're analyzing certain situations. So again, stopping short of actually making official announcements, he's saying that from a day-to-day basis, we might see more and more changes.
We may never know, Dr. Lishinesky, but with China and what they did, keeping people in their homes, I wondered a lot about what about people who need to get out for other things besides the novel coronavirus? Are you worried at all about this backfiring at all for people who aren't getting out to get things they need or getting to doctor's appointments and that sort of stuff?
No, we've set up, a call center, and also, we're taking phone calls from all of our patients with any kind of questions about those issues. I'm not really concerned about people being unable to access medical care at this time.
And Andy Chow, as far as the voting goes and shutting down those voting stations in nursing homes, where are the people that live in the nursing homes going to vote?
Not sure at this point. They might maybe try to set up some sort of absentee ballot, paper ballot situation. I'm not sure. I'm just sort of speculating at that point. That's a good question that we'll be sure to ask the Secretary of State. We do know that. So when DeWine spoke yesterday during a press conference announcing all these confirmed cases, Lieutenant Governor John Husted was also there. People might remember he is the former Secretary of State for Ohio. And he and DeWine were encouraging people to go out and vote early or to vote by mail, saying that this might be a really good a scenario where voting by mail is the best way you can reduce your contact with larger groups, reducing your contact with different surfaces that might have germs on them.
Can you still vote?
Yeah, go ahead. Dr. Lishinesky?
Are you asking about my concerns about voting?
No, I thought you were going to say something.
Oh, no.
Okay, sorry. Okay. Let's see. Ann in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I have a variety of questions, but they come down to one thing. How long does the virus live on things like skin, solid surfaces, wet claws, and tails?
Are you there?
Yes. So
I'm here.
Great question.
Okay.
Great question. We're not sure how long specifically it lives. I've seen a range, but the good news is that it is very easily killed by any normal household disinfectant.
Okay. Ann in Clintonville, thanks for that call. We have an email from Debbie. She says, does being over 60 and having osteoarthritis make me more susceptible to coronavirus? Not sure why they say arthritis puts one at risk. Dr. Lishinesky?
Sure. So osteoarthritis is not an immune-compromising condition. Rheumatoid arthritis is, but you know, over age 60 is a little bit higher risk than if, say, you were 20.
And then Dave sent us an email. He said many people in nursing homes where their polling place is and that facility can walk down to vote. They may not be able to get to vote early places. Okay, the same question I just asked is how the Secretary of State plans to accommodate them. We will find out. There is a press conference going on right now. Hopefully we'll get more information on that. In the meantime, Andy Chow, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And also, Dr. Christina Lishinesky, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. Take care.
Dr. Christina Lishinesky is an infectious disease expert at Ohio State Wexner Medical Center. And Andy Chow is an Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter. We will continue our conversation. We would like to hear from people who have hourly jobs, work in restaurants, that sort of thing. We're going to be talking about that coming up. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about the novel coronavirus and the changes it could bring as public health officials work to stem its spread. In many cases, that means staying home if you're sick. President Trump on Monday said he would work on some kind of economic relief for hourly workers.
We're also going to be talking about hourly wage earners getting help so that they can be in a position where they're not going to ever miss a paycheck. Be working with companies and small companies, large companies, a lot of companies, so that they don't get penalized for something that's not their fault.
But even that might not help the 7 million hourly workers in the U.S. who labor in the food service business and rely more on tips. 75% of Americans receive some paid sick leaves. Just one in four food service workers enjoy such benefits. That's according to government and industry data. Bob Suter is the co-founder of Wolf's Ridge Brewing in Columbus. He started a paid time off program in 2017 that includes six sick days. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Listeners, if you work in the food service business, tell us what your thoughts are, maybe what your company is planning on doing as this outbreak spreads. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So President Trump yesterday said he'd work with Republicans on relief for hourly workers, but he didn't offer much in the way of specifics. Bob Suter, what did you make of that?
Yeah, so I haven't had a time to kind of detail what exactly he's proposing, if anything, just yet. But I think that, you know, talking about the tax cut, things like that, it's not immediate enough to get to the issues that, you know, a lot of our staff specifically deal with. You know, they can't wait till tax time or, you know, every 2 weeks to kind of get some sort of small benefit that might come from a tax cut. They need to know that if they're sick or if they need to take work off, that they're going to be able to do that and not lose out on, you know, significant wages.
At the state level, Ohio House Democrats urged Governor DeWine yesterday to enact a temporary paid sick leave program to lessen the impact. But I'm still thinking about the tips. You know, in my days as a bartender, that was the majority of it. How do you compensate for that in your program for your workers?
Yeah, so that's one of the harder pieces of this is, you know, when we looked at our paid time off policy, which we started in August 2017, it was actually a little bit to try to get some parity between front of house, back of house. At the time, and to a certain extent still now, you cannot share tips from front of house with back of house. So we wanted to see if we could, you know, kind of clean that up a little bit. So the back of house, we pay them out at their normal hourly wage for their paid time off. We do get the front of house workers at their highest wage or minimum wage, depending on what they are. So the servers, we pay at their server wage, which is, I think, $4.20 plus their tips. For us, right now, a lot of our servers make significantly more than any other position in kind of the kitchen or the restaurant side of things. So, you know, for them to lose a shift would not be as detrimental as it would be for a back of house or, you know, a busser or someone like that.
Why did you start this new program?
So our kind of road to paid time off actually started a little bit earlier. We opened in September 2013, and within our first year, we had two employees who had to take time away. They're both front of house, both servers, who had to take time away for one was a planned surgery, and one was a broken leg. So we looked at how can we avoid this, because we didn't, you know, my dad and I were new to the food service industry at the time and didn't kind of think about this beforehand, but we knew that we needed to do something to, you know, take care of them in these situations. So we started paying for short-term disability for all of our staff working 25 hours or more. And that was the first step to that. So, something significant happens and they're out, you know, for really any extended period of time over a few days, we'll start paying out for lost wages. And then when we got, that covered a lot of people, but we needed to go a bit further. So we looked at paid time off. We also have what's called our employee assistance fund, which we take a portion of all of our packaged beer sales that we sell on premise, and we put that into a pool that we can then share with staff that kind of either fall below that 25-hour a week mark, or some other, you know, situation has come up. Bereavement is an example. We had a front of house employee whose father passed away, and you know, she needed a couple weeks off. You don't want to say, well, all right, good luck. You know, have fun with that. You got to do what you can. So we took, you know, portion from the employee assistance fund to support her as she was going through that.
Is what you're doing that unusual?
From my conversations with a lot of people, I think it is, unfortunately. You know, and it's interesting because I've talked a lot about paid leave at the State House and with other folks. And, you know, I think the typical business response, and I want to be fair to smaller businesses. We are, you know, we're definitely a small business, but we do have 77 employees. We were able to flex, I think, a little bit more than some smaller employers mm-hmm. might be able to. So, you know, this may not apply to every size business, but I think there are a lot in our kind of range that can do more. You know, the cost of this, it's interesting as we look at it, and since we've put the paid time off policy in place, it accounts for about 1% of our total hourly wages, the actual used paid time off. So I think if we've seen anything, it's that people aren't using it enough. You know, we can do more, you know, to make sure that they're taken care of.
Meaning not using it enough, meaning you'd really rather have them stay home, particularly if they have something that's catching or something that could make them get sicker.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But I think even beyond that, you know, are they using it to take vacation? Are they using it to, you know, give themselves a break or make sure that they have time? Because I think that's another component is that, you know, especially in the food service industry, there's often not the ability to take much in terms of time off. So, you know, I think that we could probably be doing more to make sure that they're using it.
Obviously, the way that food service front of house has been paid through tipping is a tradition in the United States. It's not necessarily that popular other places in the world. What do you make of it? You know, since you are relatively new to the business, is there any movement for change?
You know, there is, and I know a lot of restaurants, especially some larger groups, have tried it, and I think it's worked in a lot of situations. It's it's something I struggle with a lot because I do, like I said, I think there is the disparity, between certain positions, throughout the restaurant. And I'd like to get a little bit more, parity among all staff. So we're always kind of looking at ways to see how we can do that a little bit differently. We have the benefit of having kind of three different spaces. We have a restaurant, a tap room, and a private event space. So we can, again, flex with staff and we're going to try out kind of some different things. But even in those spaces, we try to be, give some equity among the staff working, especially on the front of house by doing tip sharing and payouts to bussers and some of those lower, non-tipped positions in the front of house.
But do you ever, as far as just paying people higher wages across the board and charging more for food and saying, don't bother tipping, just pay more for the food and everybody gets a better shake?
Yeah. We've definitely thought about it. I think our concern and it's what we've seen in some of the other places that have tried it is that, our customer base might not respond well to that. I think that the sticker shock would probably be enough to offset business to a certain extent. But I think there are changes with the tax code that went into effect a few years ago that allow us to do different things with tips. So we're constantly looking at that and seeing, okay, if we spread this around a little bit to make this a little bit easier. But we're also seeing wage growth in the back of house in those positions, specifically in Central Ohio. There's a lot more competition for that work. So you might start to see, other restaurants changing that, especially if on the smaller end.
Have you talked to your employees about showing up for work if they don't feel well in light of the coronavirus, and also about how to clean and sanitize the rooms?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we all obviously follow all the health regulations, and the Columbus Public Health does a great job of communicating, proper policies for flu season. So we're always aware of this going into those warm, colder months, and they follow all we follow regulations. They're required to call off if they're feeling ill, if they're showing any sort of symptoms of vomiting, flu, fever, that type of thing. And, we will tell them to not come in if that's the case. Regularly, sanitizing surfaces is part of the way we do things. Daily cleanings of all of our public and food service spaces. We do regularly scheduled deep cleans. We'll kind of pull everything out, get really deep into everything and cleaning that. The servers, wiping down the point of service stations with disinfectant wipes. And other services, changing our sanitizer, every hour to make sure that it's still, proper concentration, things like that.
Are you bracing, if there is a mass quarantine, are you bracing for that? Have you thought about it and making plans?
Yeah, it seems like things have really escalated, and we're definitely trying to be a little bit more prepared than we were maybe a week or so ago. When they canceled the Arnold Expo, we assumed that there would be a hit, but being so close to the event, we just thought maybe people would still come into town. We definitely did not see the sales that we kind of expected for this time of year, especially being close to the convention center. We typically do pretty well during that, but sales were down about 10%, at least 10%. We're already seeing an impact. We've had at least one private event cancel for next week, so I think it's going to be tough, and that's certainly a concern because we're not really sure, what's going to happen from so many sort of government, process in terms of helping out small businesses. And I think a lot of us, you're closed a week or you lose that much business, that's a significant hit.
The president also mentioned a payroll tax cut could be in the offing. It's unclear, whether he's going to be able to get Democrats and Republicans to agree in the in Congress, but be that as it may, would that make a difference to you as far as, managing the financial hit in general?
Sure, I think it depends. I mean, it you know, I think roughly we're somewhere around 8 to 10%, and you know, in our payroll taxes, that could help. But you know, if we're at a point where we're forced to close, or we're, you know, there's a quarantine to where no one comes in for an extended period of time, you know, we'll quickly, you know, max out what we can pay our staff to keep them on. So you know, if there's no payroll, the payroll tax doesn't help us at all.
Right. Exactly. We do have a little bit of news. This is from Jason Aubrey at NBC4. Has posted on Twitter that Franklin County is moving 16 polling locations out of nursing and assisted living facilities. Early voting is still open. He said he also posted that updated numbers on how many polling locations will need to move. Now at least 125 locations across 86 counties. Secretary of State Frank LaRose has said that moving polling locations out of schools would be impractical. There is also another news conference with Governor Mike DeWine at 2 p.m. today, where we'll learn more about what the state is planning. We're talking right now to Bob Suter. He's co-owner of Wolf's Ridge Brewing, and how they're managing, not just now, but over the past couple years and into the future, managing when it comes to sick time for their employees. They have a plan. They have a process. Back in 2017, they decided to they created a time off policy. If you are working at a restaurant right now and want to share the policy there, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Katie. She says, I run my own small business and can't afford health care for myself, let alone someone else. It's absurd that Trump only now considers that much of health care is out of a person's control. Too many people are going uninsured because of costs. This is America. We must do better. Bob Suter, what about health insurance?
Yeah, so we, you know, again, I completely understand that. I think that's smaller. And so we have over 50 full-time equivalents. So we are required by ACA to provide insurance. We were providing insurance before we hit that point, but we were still kind of up there and pretty close to it. You know, when you get to those really smaller size businesses, there needs to be another level of support, and that I think has to come from the government. I think that there needs to be a different way to look at this. We pay a significant amount, about 2.5% of sales go into our health, dental, vision, life insurance plans. We pay about 55% of the premiums for the health, dental, and vision, and 100% of the premiums for the life insurance. But the you know, that's our staff are paying a lot. The plans are okay. You know, some still have a $2,000 deductible that is, you know, especially on a lower income, very hard to meet.
Right.
So, you know, these are to a certain extent still just a stopgap measure for, you know, some major health issues. And I think that even with us being able to do that, it's still not enough. You know, so we've done, I think, what we can for now. Mm-hmm. We're trying to kind of look and see if we can do more, always looking at those plans. But, we've been offering that for a while now, and it's I know the staff appreciates it, but I think we as a country could probably do more to support that.
We just have about a minute left, Bob Suter. I'm just wondering what kind of questions your employees are asking you.
In terms of the coronavirus?
Yeah.
Not a whole lot. You know, we've been communicating with them. We have a weekly newsletter that goes out. We've been sharing updates from CDC and ODH and, you know, continuing to enforce, you know, frequent hand washing, just normal, you know, preparation techniques to avoid contracting the flu. But we're talking, you know, at least in my head, I've been thinking about, you know, how we communicate you know, should things get worse, what does that look like? And, you know, we're definitely thinking about that. But I think for the most part, our staff is you know, they're healthy. They've been handling this fine. And we're a very transparent business. We try to keep them in the loop. So I think we've shared all the information that we can, and you know, they know that. So.
Well, Bob Suter, thank you so much for your time today. Good luck with all of this. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. Appreciate it.
Bob Suter, co-owner of Wolf's Ridge Brewing. It's a Columbus brewery and restaurant in downtown Columbus. That's it for now. Coming up next hour, we're going to be talking to OSU President Michael Drake. So I hope you'll stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.